Again, you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody, and we're in a new time slot. We're an hour earlier, so our programs will run from 8 to 10 p.m., and I hope that's more convenient for some of you who have a tendency to have to get up the next day and go to bed around the 9 o'clock area. So I hope you'll be able to join in and listen. And we've got an email site, khen.dj@gmail.com, if you want to email any questions or to the program. And my co-host this evening is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, a professor of geography at California State University at Stanislaus with nearly 30 years of teaching experience. His academic research has focused on using ancient soils, paleosols, and landforms as a means of reconstructing climates and environmental conditions of the past. And our special guest this evening is Howard Hayden. And I believe, before I go there any further, though, I want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and are my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And I want to also bring up the fact that we had a great membership drive where we brought $3,159, but we're open for memberships all year round. So please feel free to join and contribute to the great programming that we provide this community, and we're always looking for volunteers who want to come in and add to the flock. So, Dr. Carlstrom, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. And would you like to introduce our guest?
Yeah, it's a pleasure to welcome Howard Hayden to our interview tonight. Let me just say a few words about him here on a bio. Howard Hayden is a professor emeritus of physics from the University of Connecticut. A Colorado native, he entered the University of Denver as an engineering major, but soon discovered that he wasn't temperamentally suited to all that reality. He switched to physics and went on to earn his BS, MS, and PhD at DU, University of Denver. On receiving his PhD, he went to the University of Connecticut, where he spent 32 years doing teaching and research. He did accelerator-based atomic physics, including measurements of cross-sections for various processes, measurements of energy loss and atomic collisions, and of lifetimes of excited states, beam foil spectroscopy, and ion implantation. Hayden has a long-standing interest in energy, stemming from before the OPEC oil embargoes of the 1970s. Presently, he publishes a monthly newsletter, The Energy Advocate, which in August 2010 began its 15th year of publication. He has written a couple books, The Solar Fraud, Why Solar Energy Won't Run the World, and A Primer on CO2 and Climate, both of which advanced to the second edition. The Solar Fraud has sold out and has been supplanted by A Primer on Renewable Energy. And I should mention, Howard, that I have my students in some of my classes purchase your primer on CO2 and climate, and I'm also going to have many of those same students listen to this interview, so this should be a nice way for them to get to know the author of one of their books. And so welcome to the show, and maybe I'll start by asking you, since we started off with this, I know we can range our discussion on topics such as energy and climate change and CO2 and pending legislation. But perhaps a good place to start would be, since Melody played this song, Give Me Some Truth, how much truth do you find in Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth?
Very little. In a word, he's a master propagandist, but he bends the truth out of shape quite a bit in his book, and in his movie. And in fact, I have my own quarrels with the IPCC, but he totally misrepresents them as well. In fact, his movie was being shown to school children in England, and a court ruled that it was so riddled with mistakes that they couldn't show it as a classroom exercise unless they told some of the things that were actually wrong with it.
So he gets high marks as a propagandist, but low marks as a scientist, and low marks on telling us about reality and the challenges that face us. Now, about the realities that face us, you're interested with this newsletter, The Energy Advocate. What are some of the themes, Howard, that you'd like to go into in that newsletter?
Well, if I just wrote about energy, it wouldn't take me 15 years. In fact, I could write everything that a citizen would want to know about the energy question in a matter of a few issues. But mostly I write about fools, which there are an infinite number. It's been going on for a long, long time. We keep hearing people who think you can run this industrialized giant called the world on sunbeams and chicken manure and breezes, and it simply isn't going to happen. So there are just many foolish things people say about that, and so I pick up on these foolish things and then remind people, readers, of what the actual physics is all about. So that's what's been going on for years and years.
Okay, so bottom line is that we have a world civilization that gets about 85-86% of its energy from fossil fuels, even with Obama and some Democrats talking about going green and trying to meet Kyoto Protocol targets of scaling back our quote-unquote carbon footprint, our carbon emissions. I imagine you have some thoughts about some of the pending legislation that, like the climate security bill that I believe Boxer is behind and Kerry, and is still working its way, trying to work its way through the Senate. Can you tell us what you think about the logic, the intelligence, the vision of that particular bill?
Well, it's a matter of politicians sort of entering into an arena where they have just understanding of what is going on. Let me explain just a little bit about the question of carbon dioxide. We know that the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere is increasing. We know that the temperature has increased with fluctuations over the last 150 years or so. During the last decade or so, the temperature was going down until the very recent El Nino, which seems to have spiked and is almost finished by now. But in any case, the CO2 is going up, and the temperature has been going up all this time, and it is all too tempting to think that correlation is causation. And it turns out that there is a causative effect, but it's not the one that people say, and that is that when the Earth warms up, the oceans warm up perforce, and that puts more CO2 into the atmosphere. And curiously, the mathematical relationship is identical to the mathematical relationship where CO2 acts as a greenhouse gas, which means that it's really mathematically impossible to tease out how much is cause and how much is effect. But in any case, we know for certain that the CO2 has been rising, and the ocean temperature has been rising, and they're very, very strongly correlated, and that is because the CO2 is being emitted from the ocean. In fact, the IPCC has a graph showing, well, it's not really a graph, it's kind of a cartoon with a bunch of arrows pointing this way and that, but they point out that the pre-industrial amounts of CO2 emitted by and absorbed from the atmosphere to the ocean. What used to be about 70 gigatons of carbon per year, and now it's up to about 90. Well, if just our burning of carbon dioxide were to be the cause of the increase of CO2 in the atmosphere, one would expect that the flux of CO2 into the ocean would increase, but it certainly doesn't explain why the flux of CO2 out of the ocean increases. So the only way you can explain that is on the basis that the warming ocean is the cause of the increased CO2 in the atmosphere. Okay, that much said, there is a relationship between CO2 and temperature, and it's not the one people usually say. Another part of it is, what is the harm if CO2 increases, and what is the harm if the temperature increases? Well, we have some ancient records saying that the dinosaurs lived when the atmospheric concentration was between about 4,000 and 8,000 parts per million. Presently, it's around 390. So we have a factor of somewhere between 10 and 20 or something like that to go before we get to the concentration that the dinosaurs lived with. And when you think about it, you look at the size of the bones of those creatures and you say, you know, they had to live in a very, very verdant time, because you can't grow creatures that big unless there's a whole lot to eat. And so the very high CO2 concentration there, and CO2 is, of course, plant food, led to much bigger plants in a very, very verdant world. It was indeed warmer. It was about, somewhere around 4 or 5 degrees C warmer than it is now. But, of course, that goes ahead and explains why they had so much CO2 in the air, because it was, the oceans were warm, and that's where the CO2 came from. So the increase in CO2 is not harmful. The increase in temperature is not harmful. And as a friend of mine who is a skeptical climate scientist is wont to say, well, there is a greenhouse effect due to CO2. CO2 is increasing. The temperature is warming. It's not a bad thing. We can handle it. Go find something useful to do. And we wish Barbara Boxer would.
Yeah, and of course, part of the whole equation here is that even in just our country, the government has been doling out close to $2 billion a year in research monies specifically for people to look at the issue of human-caused climate change rather than simply to look at climate change in and of itself as a natural phenomenon. So there is a political push for particular kinds of conclusions, and there's a lot of money to make that a reality, make it happen. So,
that's certainly true. But there's another great pool of money, and that is that Al Gore started a $300 million propaganda campaign a couple of years ago in order to promote his global warming scare. And the funding of it has gotten into everything. There are very many websites that are linked to Al Gore's principal website on this. And when you go to museums, it's hard to visit a museum without being hit with the propaganda. You can't watch a nature and science show on TV without being hit by the propaganda. And it's just highly infectious, and it's hard to blame the ordinary citizen for being a little bit frightened by all this, but it's all just propaganda that's doing it.
That's a very good point. As a professor, I like to, sometimes I find DVDs and videos to be very useful, but I have had to be very careful. I found some good DVDs on this topic, and there are some good ones, like the Great Global Warming Swindle, for instance. But there are also many, as you say, that link our energy use with global warming, and it's you see it in so many books and so many videos that the public is going to get the message that this is just the way it is, and so that is hard to counter that. And you're tracing this back to that $300 million propaganda campaign that Al Gore was associated with. Pretty much.
Yes,
but I suppose it's wider than that as well.
Oh, I'm sure it is, because there's probably Soros money behind it as well, but I don't know that. Interesting, about the cap and trade and taxes that people have in mind for reducing carbon emissions, take it as axiomatic that all the wind and all the solar and everything else is not going to run the world. And in fact, it's very hard, even nuclear, which has plenty adequate energy, is going to have a dickens of a time trying to run our transportation system. What kind of an extension cord are you going to use on your car? And, you know, the batteries aren't going to work and so forth. So the upshot of it is that the attempt to use cap and trade and so forth is really an attempt to limit energy usage. So let me explain just a little bit about economics at a very, very fundamental level. Suppose that there is a shortage of some commodity. Now, what happens in a free economy is that somebody figures out there's a shortage because and the prices start going up. So they increase manufacturing, thereby increasing the supply. And when they increase the supply, the price comes back down. It may not come back down as far, or sometimes it'll come way down because improved manufacturing techniques have actually reduced costs and so forth. Okay, now if we get to cap and trade and that sort of stuff, carbon taxes and so forth, you got to understand that the purpose is not to raise money in ostensibly. The purpose is actually to diminish the supply. And in fact, the plan of the IPCC and of Congress is to reduce CO2 production, which means reduce the use of our coal, oil, and natural gas by 85% by 2050. And that's a phenomenal reduction, and the purpose is to reduce the production of CO2, which means to reduce the amount of energy usage. And this creates a shortage. But what it really amounts to is laws against resupply. And so you don't have a free economy working there. You have a distorted economy where the supply is actually forcibly limited by government. And what is that going to do to the price? Well, let me give you two examples of the horror of that sort of thing. The first we have is the prohibition, which jacked up the price of booze by quite a bit and brought us the friendly mafia. Now we have the war against drugs, where the purpose is to limit supply, and we have drug wars going on and super high prices, and you and I are in danger of being mugged by somebody to get a couple hundred bucks or whatever in order to get through the next day's drugs or something like that. It's a real horror, and that's what happens when you mess around with the marketplace.
We often hear about this thing called peak oil, which is a term from geologist M. King Hubbert, who worked one of the petroleum companies back in the 50s and 60s, and predicted that for any given oil patch, an oil field, a state, a country, the world as a whole, there is in effect, a bell-shaped curve which shows the path of production of that oil supply over time, so that you start out at zero and you reach a peak, and then as the supply is of readily pumped reserves is cut in half, as you reach that halfway point, then the bell-shaped curve has to go down. And many would say, some would say that that we are at peak oil or very near it, or we're at a plateau of peak oil, and the guesstimates are somewhere between 2005 and 2035 or something for this condition, and that it's not something we can legislate away. It's just a physical reality of the earth and the fossil fuels, or the oil in particular, in the ground. Do you see a connection between this peak oil phenomenon and all this cap and trade stuff?
Well, yeah, certainly that's the story. The only thing is that Hubbard didn't really hang a date on this, but he said that eventually, with exponential growth and a finite supply, you're going to run out. And, you know, that's, you know, just elementary, simple mathematics. The thing is, we just don't know how much oil there is, because we don't even know what the source of the oil is. It's pretty clear that it's not dead dinosaurs, and there seems to be, well, to give you an example, we have enough methane clathrates, which is sort of a compressed and hydrated version of natural gas, down on the continental shelf under the ocean, to last at current U.S. energy rates, that's total energy, for something like 3,000 years. So there is no really big hurry on that. I mean, we like to find better and more sources and so forth of energy, but at least we're not in any desperate need. We don't need to do anything in the next 10 minutes or the next 10 days or the next 10 years. We may have to do it in the next 10 centuries.
Howard, yes? Wouldn't the depth of where there are some of these new drills that are so deep into the earth also be a factor in proving that that it isn't a fossil fuel, because it goes way below the depth of where any life would have contributed to that?
Well, that's probably, but we have to know the geologic history perhaps better than we do. I'm sitting here at about 5,000 feet elevation, and I'm on an ancient sea bottom. So we know that the we've had rises and falls of the various parts of the tectonic movement and so forth that amount to many thousands of feet, and going down something like 5 miles is probably getting to the limit of where something might have happened, with dinosaurs or ancient ferns or something like that. But I think we're probably beyond that, and you could be right. But the more direct version is if we look at Titan, which is a moon of Saturn, they have oceans, literally oceans of natural gas. And we've seen natural gas all throughout the solar system. Why would the universe, or why would the Earth not have its own supply of primordial methane? So we probably have it. We just have to sort of change our thinking and change our habits in order to find it. But in any case, we have plenty.
I've heard this idea that out of the ocean floor in particular, this methyl hydrate, was that what you called it?
Methane hydrates.
Methane hydrate, yeah.
Or sometimes called clathrates.
Clathrates, yeah. That this natural gas is in a near-frozen state, since it's cold down there, and that this may even have contributed to some extent to the explosion of the BP well. I've read, although you read a lot of speculation about that. But, yes, I've also read that there may be so much of that stuff on the ocean floor or below the ocean floor that we, as you say, would have thousands of years' worth of fossil fuel energy to tap into. Now, is that an accepted theory, or would you say that is still kind of one theory?
Well, there are many people that accept it. The Russians have accepted it for many, many decades, and many Americans do, and some of them don't. Since I'm not a petroleum geologist, I have no way to. I simply don't know enough to get a sampled opinion. But then again, what really matters is what you find.
Okay. Well, to go back to my question, on the relationship between all this global warming. Pending legislation, versions of the Kyoto Protocol that would call for radical scale back of our use of fossil fuel. On the possible relationship between that and peak oil, you find that to be kind of a weak connection, or do you think it's more driven by a different agenda, one of say profiteering and control of kind of the deindustrialization of our society?
Just a second, gentlemen. I just want to say that this is – I've got Professor Eric Carlstrom and retired Professor Howard Hayden speaking about global warming and various aspects of that, and this is Truth Quest with Melody. So go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'm not very good at getting into people's heads, and I try to avoid – ascribing motivations to people who do things. I understand money is a very strong motivator, but I also know that there are people out there who are rather fanatic simply in their beliefs that the human species is a scourge on the earth, and that everything that we do is somehow or another sinful crime against the earth and so forth. So there are probably many motivations behind all of this, but I do know that money is a big motivator. There was recently a carbon exchange, which is part of a sort of a network of people who have gotten together to trade carbon credits, which is totally mythware, but anyway, they have had a great financial loss simply because the cap and trade bill isn't going to pass. And so, you know, hooray for that. But that just shows that money was a motivator in that particular case.
Yeah, I think we've established in just by reading and on previous shows also that Maurice Strong of the United Nations was involved in founding the Chicago Climate Exchange, which and Enron, before it went bankrupt, was also instrumental in trying to get this kind of legislation passed so that certain major corporations could trade carbon credits. And Goldman Sachs, amongst many others, is poised to. There's a huge sector of the financial services that want to trade carbon credits, kind of as to create the next big Ponzi scheme bubble, perhaps like the housing bubble. But as you say, the legislation doesn't look promising. The climate legislation was passed in the House, but it has stalled in the Senate. And you don't see good prospects for that. Is that correct?
Not at the present time, but you have to regard the people behind this as in a regrouping mode. They haven't been defeated, and they probably never will be defeated because they come crawling out of the woodwork. So you have to be constantly vigilant against that sort of thing.
So the cap and trade ultimately is a pay to pollute.
Well, yeah, cap and trade was actually begun as a way of sort of finding a capitalist solution, as it were, to some real pollution, and that was that there was a gradually declining standard for how much you could emit, and of pollutants like sulfur dioxide and so forth that really are harmful. A company is granted a certain amount of permission to emit as much as they have been, and then if they improve their situation, then they can sell some of these credits and make a few bucks on the side and so forth. And so that's the but there was gradually declining cap and so forth, and so it worked. It was a way of essentially putting the noose around the neck of people who were polluting too much, and it did work pretty well. But the problem is that there is just simply no way to burn coal or oil or natural gas without producing carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is an odorless, colorless, non-toxic gas. And it has been vilified in the press. And so, by the way, one thing we should understand about carbon dioxide is that there is a certain amount of carbon dioxide that goes into the air every year because of the rot of detritus and emissions from the ocean and respiration and all kinds of things that are natural. And there is carbon dioxide that goes into the air because humans are burning coal, oil, and natural gas. But it turns out that our combustion of those fuels only puts 3% of that carbon dioxide that goes into the air. The rest of it is totally natural.
Yeah, and I think we should also point out that, some 80 to 90% of the total greenhouse effect is due to water vapor, which of course is also completely natural, and there have been no attempts to try to legislate against water vapor. So you can kind of see right there that that this whole thing is really not about fixing the climate; it's about something else.
Yeah, it's a lot of it is about manipulating people into some kind of a worldview about the earth we live on, and then there's a money motivation and so forth. But you're absolutely correct that the big greenhouse gas is water vapor, and it's a far more effective gas, both in terms of the breadth of the spectrum, in other words, the range of wavelengths that it absorbs, and in terms of total quantity, because there's just typically 100 times as much water vapor in the air as there is carbon dioxide in the air.
Yeah, so that we see that the total contribution of our activities to this thing called the greenhouse effect is actually much less than 1%. So when they talk about mitigating the climate by changing our behavior and reducing our carbon footprint, this is simply erroneous information. This is simply not true.
It's a flea on an elephant's behind. Just totally nothing. You're right on that.
As well, the idea that, and of course, the computer models give most of the quote unquote grist for the alarmists, in the sense that they make these projections. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is associated with about two dozen computer models that show a range of warming, always warming, never cooling, in the next century of about 2 to 11.5 degrees Fahrenheit. Choose your projection, but they never show any cooling, and this is all based on computer models rather than based on reality. But based the assumptions of the models are that carbon dioxide is the main driver, the main forcing factor in climate, which I think we can pretty much conclusively prove is not the case, as you mentioned earlier.
Howard, is there any way that you would project or could possibly project, when you were saying that they're regrouping and going to come back at us? Do you have any ideas of what they might be trying to come back and, you know, reword or change the language or the thought process so that they can come and implement this in a different fashion?
Well, I don't have any projections or any guesses as to what their wording would be, but I would say that if I consider an analogous situation of the nuclear power, there was a lot of hysterical screaming about nuclear power 30, 40 years ago and so forth. And it has it abated while we didn't build any nuclear power plants, but now that people are considering building nuclear power plants again, the same screams and hollers are coming from more or less the same quarters. It's probably somewhat different people. So I would just say that they're out there. So one way or another, people are going to be totally frightened about this, unless there is something that comes along which is, in fact, extremely likely, and that is that we enter an ice age. The ice ages, well, in a way, we are in one long million-year ice age, which is. Characterized by cold, they call it glacial periods that last something like 90 to 100,000 years, and interglacials, when it's warm as it is right now, that last perhaps 10,000 years, and it has been about 20,000 years since the depth of the last ice age, and it's sure to happen again sometime. Now, the reason behind those ice ages it has to do with the orbit of the Earth and the tilt of the Earth's axis and variations in those things. They're called Milankovitch cycles. So it will happen that we will enter some ice age, and it's going to be a long, long glacial cycle of probably somewhere around 100,000 years. So I don't know as how you and I will be here that long, but it will happen.
Yeah, I think just for perspective, I like to bring up to my students the kind of the emerging worldview that we get from a number of books and authors, that our species, Homo sapiens, seems to have evolved about 130,000 years ago, which is when we were in our last interglacial period. So what we see, if we look at the Earth's history and the history of living creatures, we see that warm periods are periods of expansion, species flourish, they live, they come into being, economies boom, and these cold periods that you're referring to are periods where we have extinction, we have social disruption, we have shorter growing seasons, shorter lifespans. So a cooling is actually much, if one wants to be afraid of the weather, which probably not very intelligent use of your emotional energy, but at least be smart enough to be afraid of cold temperatures rather than warm temperatures, which historically are associated with wealth and prosperity.
Yes, of course. And in fact, on a shorter time scale, you just go to a local emergency room and look at the records of how many people come running into the emergency room with various kinds of problems and so forth, and they peak out in the coldest weather.
Yep.
So a couple of interesting things about the history, not extending back to the real ice age, but through the little ice age. They have discovered, well, because the glaciers have receded quite a bit in the Alps, they have discovered some Roman lead mines. The Romans were up there in the Alps, way up high, digging mines to get lead. Now, they didn't go up there and find themselves on top of a gigantic glacier and think, oh, I'm going to dig a hole right here and see if I can find some lead. No way. They had reasons. They were on the solid earth, and they dug in and they found lead. And, of course, the Little Ice Age came along and covered the whole thing up with glaciers. And so now in this particular warm period, it has receded. Glaciers have receded far enough to expose the lead mines.
Yeah, I think we can extend back our kind of little history and climate lesson. And what you're talking about is the period called the Roman Warming. The Roman Empire was expanding in a time when the climate was a little bit warmer, and I think it's something like 600 BC to 200 AD, something like that. Maybe it was the other way around. Maybe it's 200 BC to 600 AD. I can't remember, but it's right around the BC AD period, followed by the Dark Ages, which was a period of cold weather, which was followed by the medieval warm period, which is the periods in which the Vikings expanded to Greenland and Iceland between about 900 AD and 1300 AD. And then that was followed by the Little Ice Age, where the climate was 1 or 2 degrees centigrade colder than now, where the bubonic plague, the shorter lifespans, etc. So we see that these natural warming and cooling cycles have had some pretty big impacts on the history of cultures, especially European ancestors.
So you're kind of saying that maybe the Romans could have contributed to a global warming?
Melody, I have to cut in because I can't hear you at all. So
okay.
I don't know what you're saying, but what I just said I was offering to Howard to comment on.
Okay.
Well, sure enough, let me give you a little vignette of things. You're aware that the United States is kind of a beer country, whereas Italy and France are wine countries. Now, why is that? Well, during the medieval warm period, they were growing grapes up all the way through the British Isles, and they were making wine. Along came the Little Ice Age, and the grapes wouldn't grow anymore, so they started making booze. In other words, beer out of grains. And it was those people who came to the New World, and they brought their habits of beer drinking with them, and that is why the U.S. is a beer country rather than a wine country. And so it's just a little story there. But another thing is that, story due to Tim Ball, who is a climatologist in Canada. He had some nice pictures of some gardens in the up in England, where what they did was to slant their gardens to the south. In other words, they built up berms in order to get better sunlight during the Little Ice Age, because that was the only way they could grow crops. It's very clever of them to do it, but after all, they were simply responding to the climate as it was there and then.
Yeah, we've had the good fortune to interview Tim Ball four times on our show, and it came out in one of the interviews that he was a PhD student of British climatologist Hubert Lamb, who has done a lot of work on climate and human history, and one of the real experts on that. So, yeah, Tim Ball is one of the quote-unquote climate skeptics or climate deniers, if you will, and has taken some heat for his being brave. But, yeah, he's still going strong and tremendously knowledgeable and has lots of good stories like that, yeah.
He really is a wonderful character, and he kind of bristles at the term climate change denier or something like that, because his business is studying how climate has changed over the long history of the Earth.
Yeah.
If there's anything he and other climate skeptics know, AGW skeptics know, is that the climate has changed, it always has changed, it always will change.
Yeah, and this is kind of a fundamental problem, because even as I read through some of the kind of the modern literature, it seems that the term climate change, and of course, since we've been cooling since about 1998, what we hear about now is not so much global warming, but we hear climate change. And you even in your book, you talk about the acronym HIGWIGS, which is human-induced global warming-induced global cooling, which, of course, is a an attempt to rationalize the fact that our global warming is causing global cooling. But what my point was that climate change, those two words, when I went to school, meant natural climate change. But those terms have kind of been co-opted now to mean, even without saying it, but to imply human causation. So climate change, as it's used in Congress, is more likely to mean human-caused climate change. So it's very hard to kind of fight against this implied meaning, which is not specified.
Yeah, it's a little bit like the old horror movies, especially of, who was that famous director? Hitchcock. Hitchcock never showed the villain, so to speak. That was always hidden from view. Even in the movie Psycho, you never got to see any horrible thing really happening. You only knew it by more or less implication, and the imagined horror was always worse than the real horror. So in this case, what they do is they toss about the term climate change, and simply avoid answering the question or even raising the question whether A, humans have anything to do with it, and B, whether it is good or bad. The implication is that humans are responsible, and yes, it's bad, but we're sure not going to say it because somebody might quarrel with it.
Yeah, it's a very interesting, subtle kind of linguistic, I guess, coup, you might say, that word has been co-opted to that extent. And but Melody, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut off your question altogether. Do you remember what you wanted to ask him? And if you could speak up as loud as you can, because I'm not hearing what you're saying.
Well, that's okay. I was just being facetious anyways, because you were saying that they had a warming period during the Roman times, and I thought I could just throw in the fact that did they contribute to the global warming? So,
well, yes, it was the Roman SUVs, but they got buried in the labyrinths, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is an interesting theory by a guy named Wallace Brooker, who is a paleoclimatologist who wrote an article, I believe, in Scientific American, in which he raised the question whether perhaps humans had been contributing to the warmth of the present interglacial, the Holocene, by our agricultural activities, which, of course, started a long time ago. It was more or less just posed as a kind of a question. He didn't answer it one way or the other, but he suggested that maybe as far back as 10,000 years ago, humans could have some impact on the climate. I think it would be very small myself. Do you have a thought on that?
Well, I would suppose that it's pretty small. I mean, how many humans were there, for gosh sakes? And what could they possibly do? And after all, the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere is controlled by the ocean temperature rather than the CO2 controlling the temperature of the Earth. So it's, well, there are many things that actually are involved in the Earth's temperature. Now, one of them is the amount of sunlight that varies a little bit. And that can actually explain more or less half of the variation that we see. But even then, when you look at solar intensity, you're looking at the broad part of the spectrum from ultraviolet through infrared and so forth, and it's coming from a sun that's around 5,800 degrees on the surface and so forth. But if you believe that's all the sun can do, then you're at a loss to explain why the tails of comets point away from the sun. In other words, it was known for a long time, or somebody discovered, that the tails of comets actually point away from the sun. And somebody did a calculation based on the known temperature of the sun and said, you know, that couldn't possibly send enough stuff that far out into space, you know, past Jupiter or something like that, to force the tail of the comet to go away from the sun. And so there was a Mexican standoff, so to speak, until we found ourselves getting into outer space and we actually found the solar wind, which is an electrodynamic phenomenon. And, oh, all of a sudden we have a reason now why these comet tails should point away from the sun. And when the climate people talk about the sun, they pay no heed whatsoever to the variations in the sun, and they also pay no, well, I shouldn't say that. They say that, yeah, it's a small effect. That's what they say. But they pay no attention to those very violent phenomena that are clearly strong enough to push the tail of a comet away when it's five times as far from the sun as we are. And those things simply don't enter into the calculations these people make. So, but anyway, there are other things, such as the albedo of the Earth, which is the reflectivity. A very slight change in the albedo of the Earth can cause a considerable change in the Earth's temperature. And then there are things like the ocean cycles. There are short-term cycles like the El Nino Southern Oscillation, which goes back and forth between El Nino and La Nina. There's the Pacific Oscillation. There's another oscillation in the Atlantic. And there are some long-term cycles that run thousands of years. And those all have an effect on the surface temperature. So just trying to put that into a computer and get it figured out is really quite an effort. And in fact, I have a nice demonstration that I have a video of where somebody has what's called a double compound pendulum, which is basically a stick hanging on a stick, and the upper stick is hanging on a pivot and so forth. And you start swinging this thing, and you get some motion out of that that is totally unpredictable. And you can't solve that with a computer. I mean, if you know the conditions that are happening right now, you can tell what's going to happen in a matter of the next 4 seconds or something like that. But you have to have infinite precision in all of your knowledge about the friction, about air friction, the shapes of the things, the exact conditions, velocity, and so forth, in order to be able to predict very far into the future. Well, if you can't solve that with a computer without all that super high precision knowledge, how can you possibly put together computer models that are able to explain climate over 100 or 1,000 year time periods? I mean, it's a fool's errand.
I think you're right. It is a fool's errand. There's a great paragraph that I'd like to read out of a book by Professor Ian Plimmer called Heaven and Earth, Global Warming, the Missing Science. And I actually am having my climatology class to read that, this book, this semester. On page 11, it says, calculations on supercomputers, as powerful as they may be, are a far cry from the complexity of the planet Earth, where the atmosphere is influenced by processes that occur deep within the Earth, in the oceans, in the atmosphere, in the sun, and in the cosmos. And the next sentence is the one I really like. To reduce modern climate change to one variable, CO2, or more correctly, a small proportion of one variable, i.e. human-produced CO2, is not science, especially as it requires abandoning all we know about planet Earth, the sun, and the cosmos.
Yeah.
I think he sums it up. Yeah, and in your book, you make the point that there may not just be one cause for a particular warming, that you may have synergistic effects of many, 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 many different factors. And there are so many different factors that affect the very, very, very sensitive atmosphere climate system that to try to put it all on a graph with an X and a Y axis, it may be the height of folly to say, oh, well, 1998, that was all due to El Nino, or 1981 is all Pinatubo, or this cooling is due to this, or this cooling is due to that. Maybe that is a stretch that is not justifiable.
Yeah, in the laboratory we can do an experiment where we change exactly one variable and then we see an effect from that. But with all natural phenomena, there is just plain no such thing as the cause, and that's just all there is to it. Incidentally, Eric, I've never met you, and Melody, I've never met you. We're sitting here on our telephones in our respective places, and I certainly haven't met any of the readers who are listening to this show, but let me say that we all have one thing in common. We probably have more than that, but there's one thing of interest in common, and that is we have been in a room, an auditorium perhaps, where somebody was messing with the sound system, and all of a sudden there is this horrible screech. And the screech is caused by sound from the speakers being heard loudly enough at the microphone that it gets into the microphone, gets amplified, gets worse and worse and worse, and you get this scream. We've all had that experience. And this comes from what's called positive feedback or regenerative feedback. Now, suppose this happened sometime, and instead of having somebody cover up the microphone or turn down the amplifier or do whatever they did, pull the plug, suppose that everybody just walked out of the room and locked the door. Now, that scream would persist and persist and persist and persist. And if the power never went off, that scream would go on forever. And so what I want to do is discuss that as a tipping point phenomenon, that once that microphone is close enough to the speaker, you get to this point where it tips and the sound just gets louder and louder and gets as loud as it can possibly get. And the climate alarmists are worried that we're approaching such a point. Well, now, my answer to that is, well, let's have a look at history and say, how much carbon dioxide has there been in history? Well, the carbon dioxide concentration has generally been going downhill for something like 100 million years. Maybe it's only 10 million, but
it's been going down for 3 billion years. It's been going down since the early atmosphere as it's been taken up in rocks.
Well, actually, there was a very low CO2 period around 275 million years ago, but then it came back up. But there has been a general slope downward for, I think it's 10 million years. But in any case, many times in the past, it was much, much higher than now. Now, the point is that if that high CO2 had led to a tipping point, the Earth would have gotten hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter and would have stayed that way. And we wouldn't be here talking about it.
Gentlemen, let me go ahead and say this is KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado. And you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody. And we're streamed on the internet at khen.org, and our programs are archived at www.gimmesometruth.info. And if you have any questions for the program, you can email in at khen.dj@gmail.com, khen.dj@gmail.com. And this evening I have Professor Eric Carlstrom and our retired professor, Howard Hayden, discussing the effects of global warming amongst other issues. And he also produces the newsletter, The Energy Advocate. And I'll let you gentlemen go ahead.
Okay, back to what I was saying here about these tipping points. If the Earth had, let's put it this way, if some given amount of carbon dioxide, say 1,000 parts per million or 2,000 or 4,000 parts per million or something like that, were enough to get us to a tipping point, the Earth would have heated up and gotten hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter, and it would have simply stayed that way because that is the nature of a tipping point. The fact that we are here talking about it proves that those high values of CO2 were in no way adequate to get us to such a tipping point, and so there is simply no reason to worry about 400 or 440 parts per million that some people are totally freaked out about. There was simply not going to be a tipping point. It's time to just grow up and study a little bit of history.
Yeah. Well, actually, in your own book on page 10, figure 8, you do show various estimates of past carbon dioxide, and it's for the last approximately 550 million years. And for most of that time, it's a lot higher than now. And in fact, we're at all-time lows right now. So the idea that carbon dioxide increase is somehow going to be a catastrophe does fly in the face of what we know about the Earth's history entirely. It doesn't make any sense. Like you say, you're just going to have to go back and take a few courses at college or read a book or something to divest yourself of that fear. Richard Lindzen calls this whole thing, and he's an MIT professor of meteorology, calls this whole thing the revenge of the sea students, because people like Al Gore, you know, maybe took one course that was related to the environment or two and got C's and D's in them. And now, of course, he puts himself out as this environmental expert and has done amazing campaign worldwide with this movie and this slideshow presentation that he has done. One really must start to wonder. Of course, I understand he's a billionaire, so his investments have paid out fairly well, I guess.
Would you gentlemen also like to give your websites so that anybody that might be interested in seeing the work that you're doing along these lines, they could...
Well, sure. I could mention that I am working on a website, and my students are actually hopefully going to help me with that a little bit with some of the PowerPoint presentations that they do this semester. It's called www.naturalclimatechange.us, and of course, the function is to try to educate people in a fairly accessible manner about how climates change on their own naturally and have done so on various scales in the past. So, and yours, Howard?
Mine is www.energyadvocate.com, no spaces, no blanks, energyadvocate.com. I am not terribly good about keeping it up to date, but there are quite a number of interesting essays there. Most of them, by the way, are about energy per se rather than global warming, although there are some in there. So
I would have to say I'm the same with my website. It's hard for me to keep it updated. I've been told there's only two kinds of people in the world now. There's digital immigrants and digital natives. And I'm an immigrant. I don't feel like a native. Struggling to maintain a website is an interesting challenge.
My brother once applied for a job, actually got a job out at Lockheed, but the chap in personnel told him that, they seem to need a lot of people that know something about computers. So we go back a little ways there. And the first time I programmed a computer, it was using paper tape, after which the IBM card was a marvelously improved device.
Yeah. Well, I remember the big old mainframe computers at the University of Calgary where I got my PhD, and we would have stacks of cards that would go into this mainframe, and we'd wait for several hours for the computer printout to come out, and then it sure has been revolutionized since then. And with many, many positives, as well as I think the negative that I see is that what has occurred here is something that we talked about even when I was in graduate school with computer programs. We called it GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. Your conclusions can be no better than your assumptions. And the problem with the computer models that I see are many. Some of the main ones are that, number one, they assume that CO2 is the major forcing factor. Number two, they assume more or less static climate prior to any human intervention. And everything we know about the Earth's history shows that the Earth's climate is anything but static. To summarize it, basically, about 80% of the Earth's history, we were in a hothouse condition, considerably warmer than now. You threw out the figure 4 to 5 degrees centigrade warmer. I've seen graphs where it's more like 8 or 10 degrees centigrade warmer. But anyway, warmer than now. And then for about 20% of the Earth's history, we go into these ice ages, these cold house conditions, where it can be 8 or 10 degrees centigrade colder than now. And when we had the snowball Earth about 600 million years ago, estimates are the whole Earth was as cold as minus 40 degrees centigrade. So that was close to a tipping point. And yet we bounced back in the Cambrian explosion, and we went from single cell to multiple cell, multicellular life. So we have a very rich and distinguished and complex history of climate change, and yet our modelers, to make the models simplified enough to use them, ignore this and don't put any of those things in the model. They also can't model clouds because they're too complex. So they want us, and I'll say one more thing, and that is that the science of chaos comes out of the study of meteorology, and that's the idea that two nonlinear systems interacting cannot yield predictable results in the case of the weather you can't predict the weather for more than a week or 10 days at the most, and that's because of the chaotic condition of the weather system. So how can we possibly predict what's going to the weather is going to be in 100 years if we can't, or the climate's going to be in 100 years if we can't predict the weather in 10 days, especially since we don't understand it. So the problem that I see is that the computer reality becomes a virtual reality unto itself. And then use these simplifying assumptions, and then that becomes your reality, and you don't look over your shoulder and check it against the real world. And what I see with the digital natives coming along, who are my students, some of them are deep into that mindset, and it's kind of hard to pull them out of it to get them to look at, well, what I would call reality.
Yeah, let me bring up about three things, if I can remember them all in order. The first one is just a vignette, but I knew a high school teacher in southern New York. At about the time that the Texas Instruments SR-51, that's an electronic slide rule, came out, and that calculator had a very nice feature, and that is if you would feed in a bunch of X and Y data, it would find the best straight line to fit the X and Y data. It's called the least squares fit for the people that know about these things. But anyway, he explained to them what the least squares technique was all about, and then he gave them a bunch of numbers. And mind you, that was a fairly wealthy school district, and the kids all had this expensive calculator, which I cost me $186.50, a pretty nice calculator. Now I can get one for a buck. But anyway, he sent him home to do a calculation on a bunch of data points he gave them. And they came in, and they had a straight line with a slope that they would report to 10 significant figures, and an intercept they would report to 10 significant figures. And when they all handed it in, then he went to the chalkboard, made a graph, put the points on the graph, and they were points of a circle. And in other words, you don't fit a straight line to a points on a circle. The second point that I wanted to make was that you mentioned before there's a couple dozen different computer models of the climate, which is true. I think there's even up to 40. But if you look at the results, and all you got to do is go to the IPCC website and start looking at graphs, you find out there's a whole bunch of spaghetti graphs in there. This model predicts this model predicts that, and so forth. Well, some of them are projections into the future, but a whole lot of them are representing, let's call it, the present state of knowledge. And, you know, sort of things where you can compare one model against another one and so forth. And I know of one particular graph where the lowest to the highest is a factor of 3,000. And in some cases, they disagree by, 20-30%. In some cases, they differ by factors of 10 or 20 or something like that. And so I would ask, in fact, I do ask these people, if you claim that the science is settled, would you please tell me which of these models settled the science so that we can stop spending billions of dollars on the others?
Yeah, that's a fair question. Since much of this money, this funding, is coming from taxpayers, perhaps those are the kinds of questions that taxpayers should try to get answers for, yeah.
Right. There's one more interesting sort of a concept that I think we ought to discuss here for the moment, and that has to do with cause-effect relationships. Now, we do a lot of things in elementary science, but what I want you to do is just to imagine that you're in not in college physics, not in high school physics, but way back in sort of the discovery phase of science in middle school or junior high, as we used to call it. So a teacher gives you a string, a little ball, and you make up a pendulum, and then you measure the length of your pendulum, and you time the period, how long it takes to do a complete oscillation. And you do this for a bunch of lengths, and then you make up a graph. You put the chart in, you make up a chart with the length in one column and the period in the other column, and then you make up a graph with the the horizontal axis being the length of the pendulum, the vertical axis being the period, and you get a bunch of points there, and you can sort of join them with a nice line that has a little bit of curvature to it, something like that. It's not enough to tell you the equation, and perhaps at that age you're not interested in the equation of it. But the thing is that you can regard that as a graph of effect on the vertical axis versus cause on the horizontal axis. That is, the cause is the length of the pendulum, and the effect is the period, how long it takes to oscillate. Well, now, in global warming, I hate to call it theory because it's so far from theory that it's pathetic. It's a hypothesis. There is such a thing as what they call forcing. Now, forcing amounts to, let's call it heat retention, measured in thermal watts per square meter, averaged over the entire globe. And this is, in terms of numbers, it's small, you know, like 3, 4, 5, something like that, watts per square meter, versus 1,000 coming in from the sun. And so the forcing is supposed to be the cause, and the effect is supposed to be the temperature change of the Earth. There's many things that contribute to the forcing, one of which is carbon dioxide, another of which is water vapor, another of which is natural gas, another of which is aerosols, emissions from volcanoes, blah, blah, blah. And supposedly the IPCC knows these figures, not for the future, but they certainly would say they know them for the past. So they could, for every given year, for every decade or something like that, they could write down in a table what the forcing is. And they could also write down in the table what the temperature is. And so they could go back and say, well, the forcing from 1900 has changed up to whatever it is in 2010. The temperature has changed during that time as well. So what they can do is use the increase in forcing and the increase in temperature since sometime, say, 1900, and plot them up in a graph where they have the forcing as the cause on the horizontal axis and the temperature rise on the vertical axis. Now, I hope this is making sense to all listeners. It's a graph. A similar graph would be made by people in toxicology with the dose of a drug or something bad on the horizontal axis and the effect measured in, well, whatever units on the vertical axis, and they'd make a graph up. They're called dose response curves. Well, the dose response curve for the climate would be the dose is whatever the additional forcing is, and the response is whatever the change in temperature is. Now, so what we're talking about here is a very, very fundamental middle school approach to the basic science of climate, or in this case of global warming. Now, it comes as a surprise to many people that I have talked to, and many sophisticated people who have been paying attention to this discussion for years, that the IPCC has never at any time produced such a graph. They have never plotted the effect versus the cause, and yet they insist they understand the cause-effect relationship. It's just silly.
That's a very good point. I appreciate the way you explained that. And in regard to that, one thing that we've noticed is that there's been a tremendous response by people from all over the world to this issue. Many have set up websites. I couldn't even imagine how many websites there are now that address this, and blogs. And one can get on the internet and learn an awful lot from some of these sites, and realize how sophisticated at least certain people are, from all around the world. I'm thinking of some sites that I've seen, especially from Australia. And so to that extent, I guess I'm a little optimistic that this issue, which is now pressed upon us a little bit like a gun to the head, is mobilizing public interest to the extent that I think maybe our kind of collective understanding of the climate system is increasing very, very rapidly. Do you see some positives there?
Well, I'm sure it is. It's a matter of gathering up the data and letting it out there and so forth, and getting past the flack, because whenever you encounter a blog, as it were, about written by someone who is very much, well, let's call it a climate alarmist, they almost always call climate or skeptics, scientific skeptics, by names. They call them names. They call them deniers, you know, trying to say that the skeptics deny that the climate changes, which is false enough to be considered a lie, but they want to sort of associate it with Holocaust deniers, just to sort of demean the people who are skeptical about the science.
That's certainly true. Yeah, there are even I think James Hansen of the Goddard Space Studies Institute has suggested that these deniers should be locked up, and this guy is one of the main climate alarmist advocates who it has gotten very polarized, and there's no question that it's gotten mean-spirited, especially coming from, I think, the climate alarmist side. That would be my perspective. I guess I'm trying to see through that and beyond that to some positive net effects. Maybe I'm wishful thinking on that. I don't know.
Well, yeah, it kind of depends on the crowd you run with and so forth. But there was one interesting thing that happened at the International Conference on Climate Change, which was run by the Heartland Institute for the last several years. The last meeting in 2010, May in Chicago, they had a climate quasi-alarmist from Colorado State University, who came to give a talk. Now, it turned out I had actually heard him give a similar talk before, and he talked in this session that I did. And at the end of the conference, he stood up and gave his thanks to the people there who are all in the climate skeptic camp. That he was very impressed with the group as a whole, and he had heard a number of very interesting and thoughtful papers. And my feeling is that he went there thinking that that wasn't going to happen, and because the climate the model makers and so forth think they're the cat's meow because they're using supercomputers, which are just super fast garbage in, garbage out machines, and they think they understand climate, although their knowledge of climate can't begin to compete with what a climatologist actually knows.
Yeah, and going back to the kind of the nasty side of this, there's a book by Patrick Michaels, who is the state climatologist of Virginia, called Climate of Extremes. And in his preface, he talks about several state climatologists who were forced out of their positions by their political superiors for speaking the truth, what they know about climate, and objecting to manipulation of information and perception. So yeah, there one of the books that I think is excellent, a guy named Fred Singer has been involved in these Heartland conferences. He has mentioned in his book that there's a public relations campaign of enormous proportions that has been pushed on the public to make us think that the warming or the climate change is unprecedented, that it's catastrophic, that it's bad, and that humans have caused it, none of which are correct. And but yeah, going back to the conference, Howard, is this a conference that you've attended for a while, and do you consider it to be? Are you going to be going in the future? I ask this mainly because I'm interested in going. Perhaps I don't know. Is this something that you found very worthwhile?
Yes, I have. I went to the conference in 2008 and 2009, both in New York City, and then 2010 in Chicago. And yes, they're very, very good conferences. And you actually can log on to the Heartland website and see videos of the 2010 conference, and you can download the PowerPoints, and it's very, very worthwhile to do. It will keep you enthralled. It's just heartland.org, and you can look up there and find the 2010 conference, and you have to poke around. You can find the 2009 and the 2008 as well. So I certainly recommend doing it.
And I would imagine there's one coming up soon, this fall. Is that correct?
No, they have them usually around May or June.
May or June, okay.
Gentlemen, let me go ahead and say this is, again, Truth Quest with Melody, and that we've got Professor Eric Carlsham as a co-host, and we're interviewing retired professor Howard Hayden. And I have a question. I've run across something. You know, you're talking about, you know, you hear a lot about carbon credits, but I noticed that there's also water credits. Have you heard anything about this?
Well, not about water credits, although that might be I mean, it certainly would be something that would be possible to do in the state of Colorado and Kansas and so forth, where we have a shortage of water, where a farmer has a certain allocation and then he can sell it to somebody else. That sort of water trading has gone on for a long, long time, but I just never heard it referred to as water credits.
Okay, right. And there's another, and I wish I could remember the name of it, but there's actually some sort of a system that they're going to be gauging on, you know, how much water it took to raise some grow things and then how much travel is involved. And so I don't know if it's going to tie in with the carbon credits or not, but when we think that they've just started with the carbon credits and the climate change, they may have a whole lot more in store for us.
Oh, I see. Yeah, this is guilt trip stuff, I guess. Gee, you shouldn't be watering your crops. Well, actually, truth be known, we have a lot to learn from the Israelis, who use this drip system with very little water in the desert, and they have made the desert bloom. They've done a wonderful job of that, and we tend to be a little bit, in fact, quite a bit wasteful with water. And one of the problems with being wasteful of water is that you get erosion and it takes your topsoil away. So there are just some better farming practices, of course, but they're coming along all the time. The business of just tilling the soil and putting in seeds and doing it year after year is sort of becoming a thing of the past.
One other question to go along with some of this things that go around this, you know, carbon credits and weather, global warming, is weather modification. What are your feelings about this and how it might tie in with any of this, or the technologies that are involved? Are you up on the modification, weather modification?
Well, you can do a little bit of weather modification if you can seed clouds. If they happen to be just exactly right, you can get some rain out of them and so forth. But generally speaking, it's a little bit hard to do. And, after all, this is a pretty big Earth. it's a little hard to modify the weather very much.
Well, you know, in that regard, Eric Holdren, I guess, with the title of Science Czar, in February made a statement to the effect that the threat of global warming is so dire that we're going to have to look at some geoengineering ideas in order to mitigate the climate. And of course, there have been lots of really pretty goofy ideas put forth, you know, putting mirrors up in space and putting carbon black in the atmosphere, and many of which have actually already been experimented on. So is it possible that some of these, well, and of course there is this thing called weather warfare that the Air Force is very interested in. Is it possible that the global warming thing is somewhat of a cover for some geoengineering weather warfare operations?
Well, I don't really think so. By the way, it's John Holdren, not Eric.
Okay.
Eric,
I guess, I must be thinking of somebody else. John Holdren, okay, yeah,
it's John Holdren. He's the science czar.
Yeah.
He is, at least in the past, a livid anti-nuke as well. I mean, he goes back a long, long time. But no, I don't imagine that there is any easy way to control any part of the weather. It just doesn't seem well. There are things that can be done in a way. One of them is that if you just use some very, very fine iron powder and spread it around in the ocean, you greatly enhance the growth of what are they, not diatoms? What the heck are those?
Plankton, phytoplankton.
Plankton, yeah, phytoplankton and so forth, and they can suck a lot of CO2 out of the air or out of the water, and of course those things affect the relationship between the CO2 in the ocean and the CO2 in the air, which reminds me, by the way, Tom Siegelstad had a very nice video of an experiment that he did, and it's something that you could do in your class. There is a sort of an ancient experiment where you take a candle, float it on some water, and then you turn a glass upside down, and as the carbon dioxide or as the candle burns, then you wind up having some the candle burns out, and then water comes up into the glass. And this was incorrectly attributed by my eighth grade science teacher to the fact that there's about 20% of the atmosphere being oxygen. It actually is due to a heating effect. That is that you have a hot air on the inside, and when it cools down, then it contracts and draws the water up. But in any case, what Tom Siegelstad did was to put first some calcium hydroxide into the water. And then when he did this burning and so forth, then what you saw was that the water would suddenly turn white. And the reason the water turned white was a reaction where the calcium hydroxide is ionized in the water, and when the carbon dioxide from the air gets into the water, it makes calcium carbonate, which is basically limestone, and it makes this white precipitate. And it's really kind of a very dramatic phenomenon to see happening. And it's because the CO2 is going from the air into the water. So it's kind of a nice demonstration of how the water actually controls the atmospheric CO2.
Yeah.
So Let's see. What other bases ought we to cover on?
Well, I think we've hit some very interesting points. But since we're talking about water, there's a whole kind of litany of, I guess, what I and probably you would agree are our propaganda talking points surrounding the issue. The mosquito line, which doesn't exist, which is in your book, but shown in the movie with Al Gore, has been pretty well refuted. The polar bears dying off, which is implicated in the movie, but the biological studies show that polar bear communities are, in fact, doing quite well. Most are that have been studied anyway. And the ice is melting scenario. Come to find out that the icebergs calve or ice calves off glaciers and icebergs form all the time, and that in fact ice is accumulating in Antarctica, which has 90% of the Earth's ice vertically, and as it is also in Greenland, and that there are many spots in the world where glaciers are advancing. So we have all this series of propaganda talking points, again, each of which can be disproven. One of them is that the idea that the ocean could be acidified, that the burning of fossil fuels could cause the pH of the ocean to drop, and that this would be bad for coral reefs. Is this something that you have looked into at all?
Well, yeah. Let me just mention something about mosquitoes, and then I'll get to the reefs and stuff. There was a talk at the 2009 conference by Paul Reiter, who is a tropical disease specialist, and he had a beautiful picture of an ice sculpture in Yakutsk, Siberia. And then the next slide showed the number of malaria cases in Yakutsk, and it has dropped I can't remember the numbers, but from 33,000 down to about a dozen since about 1900. So they had a lot of malaria in Yakutsk, Siberia, a long time ago. Okay, now we'll get to the acidification and stuff. If you come here to Pueblo, I'll be glad to take you out and show you a bunch of mounds out here on the northeast side of town that turn out to be ancient coral reefs. So and that is when this part of the world was underwater. And so the coral reefs have been around for the better part of a billion years, and they have survived all kinds of changes that the Earth has gone through, and I mean some really, really violent changes. They've survived the very warm weather of that the dinosaurs lived through. They have survived the ice ages. They have survived meteoric impacts. They have simply survived for billions of years, or at least a billion years. And something will happen occasionally where they die off. But the color that you see, I mean, they always talk about bleaching. Well, the color that you see on a coral reef is never from the reef itself, but from the bacteria and so forth that inhabit it. And they change from time to time. So the bleaching doesn't necessarily mean that the corals have died. One of the world's experts on coral reefs is Craig Idso. And he has a book out which is available at valeslake.com. It's also available on Amazon. It's called something like CO2 Climate and Coral Reefs or something like that. Anyway, it's by Craig Idso, I-D-S-O. And it discusses the whole issue, and he, as one of the world's experts on it, is in no way concerned that the coral reefs are going to all die off. So
he is not concerned. He's not seeing any evidence of that. In terms of actually taking measurements of the pH of the ocean, of course, the ocean is a little bit on the alkaline side. It's salt water. It's probably got a pH of, what, 8.1 or something like that?
Around
8.0.
8.2, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Have there been, to your knowledge, measurements that show acidification of, say, down to 7.9 or something like that?
No.
Yeah.
Okay. It's all hypothetical.
Yeah. Probably generated by a model.
Well, yeah, and the pH of the ocean is not the same everywhere you go. After all, you remember that the pH is a logarithmic function. And so it takes a whole lot of acid to change a pH from 8 to 7, which would be neutral. And moreover, when the CO2 does go into the ocean, it doesn't simply make things acidic, but it provides some nutrients for biological material, and so that keeps it from becoming involved in the pH question.
Yeah. And when we look at the research that's been done on the carbon cycle, we see that there's roughly 50 times more carbon in the ocean than there is in the atmosphere under normal conditions, and that, as you said, the ocean is always taking in CO2 when it's a little cooler and giving it off when it's a little warmer. So this is all part of the natural cycle. So I guess what I'm leading to is it appears that this ocean acidification argument is also very weak.
Yeah, it's a red herring. It isn't a worrisome thing at all. It simply isn't. By the way, I knew of a fellow who used to do a neat experiment where he would just go to some place to give a talk, and he would go out into the woods and just get a shovel full of dirt, and he'd put it into a funnel. And then he would go in to give his talk, and he would get some distilled water and measure the pH. And then he would pour it through the rubble he had gotten at the soil from the forest, which has a lot of biological material in it, so forth. The water would run through there and come out the bottom of the funnel. He'd put his pH meter in there and find out that the water suddenly became acidic. And it turned out that in the Finger Lakes region, one of the main reason for the acidification of lakes had to do with the fact that 50-100 years ago or something like that, that was farmland, and then it became unfarmed because it's really hard to compete with the Ohio River Valley, you know, so they just let it go back to trees. I mean, you get all this detritus at the bottom, and the rain runs through that and goes down into the lakes and makes them acidic. So the acidification was due to humans, but humans letting the trees grow back. So
the forests would be more acidic than the agricultural activity. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's just the characteristic of forest vegetation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, you know, in terms of what you see happening with the big energy picture, with your energy advocate, there's an impression or a suggestion there that you're really kind of apologizing for, in favor of the current mix of energy. Basically, fossil fuel. Would that be correct in the sense that you're trying to get some perspective to people saying that this stuff, you know, fossil fuels, yeah, the combustion of fossil fuels may provide some local pollution. There's no question for the air and the water, but CO2 is not a pollutant. And if we look at the benefits that come from civilization, for instance, that it's a trade-off that's more than worth it. Would you say that kind of is where you're coming from on that?
Well, of course. Every time, let's say, we move something, we bend something, we shape something, we cut something, we heat something, we cool something, every time we do anything to anything, it takes energy. And 85% of our energy comes from coal, oil, and natural gas. I mean, and a large part of the rest comes from nuclear and hydro. And we also get a certain amount of energy from biomass, especially firewood. The business of ethanol and so forth is totally phony. We don't get enough energy to amount to anything. In fact, the net energy is absolutely trivial, but because it takes a lot of energy to produce all that corn ethanol. But the thing is that we simply absolutely require energy. And people who don't have a scientific background just often don't have much of an understanding. They understand they have to fill their car with gas or they can't go, but they very often kind of have a nearly mystical belief that there's some kind of energy out there that's clean and wonderful and so forth. Well, the best we have is nuclear. In any case, let me give a couple of figures that are kind of interesting. The best renewable energy that we have at the present time in terms of quantity of energy produced by this source is wind. Now, these wind turbines are huge, and in a good wind, the tip of that rotor is going around somewhere around 200 miles an hour. It looks like something making lazy circles in the sky, but the end of that is really whipping around, and so that's big, heavy machinery. Well, suppose we double the diameter of a wind turbine, then we actually can get four times as much power out of that wind turbine. But in a wind farm situation where we have windmill here and a windmill there and so forth, we have to double the distance between the wind turbines in both directions, that is fore and aft and side to side. So that means we have four times the land area. So if we have four times the power and four times the land area, that means the amount of power you get per unit land area is a constant. And right now you're probably asking yourself what that number is, and the answer is that in a good wind site, where you have winds coming from more or less random directions, you can get about 5 kilowatts per acre on year-round average power. Now, to put that into context, if you had a city of 700,000 people, it requires 1 billion watts averaged around the clock. So that amounts to 300 square miles worth of wind turbines, which is
300 square miles for a city of 1 million.
For a city of 700,000.
700,000, okay.
Yeah, that's 1,000 megawatts of power.
Yeah.
But the other interesting fact about wind turbines is that the power is proportional to the wind speed raised to the third power. In other words, the cube of the wind speed. So if the wind is going along at 20 miles an hour, which is not too common, and it suddenly drops to 10, all of a sudden you have lost 87.5% of your power. Alternatively, if it's going at 10 miles an hour and suddenly increases to 20 in a gust, all of a sudden you have 8 times as much power. So the meaning of all this is that the wind power fluctuates so badly that if it is a significant fraction, meaning over about 10% of the power on a grid at any given time, it becomes very, very hard to keep the line voltage and line frequency stable. And so the best you can hope for wind is that it plays a very minor role. It simply can't handle the whole job. So you have these arguments against wind that are just based on the physics. One of them is you got the high tip speed, which is fatal to birds and bats. You've got the very feeble power, which means you got to have tremendous land area to get much power. And then you have the tremendous fluctuations just make it very, very hard to use wind power. And then we'll throw in a fourth one, and that is that if the nameplate power is a million watts, you're only going to average 350,000 for the year for a well-designed wind turbine in a very good place. In other words, you're only getting 35% of what it says on the generator. So that makes wind very uncompetitive with conventional energy sources. And the only reason, there are two reasons why anybody, any utility wants to use wind. The first one is that they have massive subsidies and tax benefits, and so the utility that puts in wind winds up smelling like a rose. And the other one is that they have government mandates, in other words, the government telling utilities that they have to get some certain and highly unrealistic fraction of their energy from renewable sources. And so you have bizarre things like a little utility in Colorado Springs looking around to buy wind power from, let's say, upper Minnesota, where they have some wind farms. The power in Minnesota doesn't get anywhere near Colorado Springs, but on paper it looks great. We have so much of our power coming from renewable sources. And without those mandates and tax benefits and that sort of thing, wind power would die a very rapid death.
Yeah, there's an excellent video by a Canadian engineer by the name of Lightfoot, I believe, called Nobody's Fuel, Why Energy Use is More Important Than Climate. And he makes an extremely fundamental, basic, important point, which is that our wealth, our living standard, is directly tied in with our energy usage, to the extent that if we were to reduce, say, by 80% our use of fossil fuels by 2050, which is one of these Kyoto-type targets, we would also commensurately reduce our living standard and our wealth by 80%, exactly the same amount. So we would then go from a first-world nation status to an extremely poor third world nation status, simply by, unless we could find some other energy strategy that would fill that gap, and he doesn't see one on the horizon.
Right. Incidentally, Doug Lightfoot and I were at a conference in Aspen some years ago, some sort of a silly global warming conference, and we were the only two skeptics. So he and I have a lot in common, and I recommend his little video. It's a good one. He did a good job.
Do you
he throws in a lot of information. Sorry, go ahead, Melody.
Do you gentlemen feel that you're making any headway with this information among your colleagues and at the universities and among the population in general?
Well, it's hard to say. I have taught a few courses over at a local university, but there is kind of a coterie of true believers of anthropogenic global warming over there, and I've even challenged them to a debate, and they refuse to debate. They simply won't. I gave a talk at the Convention of Professional Engineers in Denver some years ago, and Bill Gray did too. And Denver's not far from NOAA up in Boulder, or NCAR, National Center for Atmospheric Research, where a lot of the people served on the IPCC committee. They came, you know, and they were invited to talk to the professional engineers who are the elite of engineers, and they found out that there'd be some skeptics giving talks, and they decided it was better to trim their toenails than to come talk in a debate situation, or even to give a talk when somebody might talk about the other point of view. So that kind of person, I think, is just totally hopeless. But the public, I think, is beginning to come around. They're beginning to see that this is a wholly phony scenario that these people have proposed, at least some of them have.
Well, would you gentlemen like to kind of sum up what we've discussed here? So, or have any closing comments?
Well, I'll just say a couple words and then leave the last word to our guest, Howard Hayden. It's been a real pleasure to have you to interview for 2 hours. I think the mix of interests that you have right now, energy and climate change and carbon dioxide, is extremely germane and important. This is what people need. This is kind of the basic information that people need, which people don't have by virtue of the fact that I think that our media has almost a propaganda value by repeating certain lies, especially coming out of the BBC. We hear every day, oh, the warming is worse than we thought. There's more ice melting than we thought. There's more polar bears dying than we thought. Well, all of this stuff's coming from, you know, kind of a computer-based virtual reality. Ian Plimmer, who wrote, again, this excellent book, Heaven and Earth, he's a professor of earth science in Australia, believes that this push of anthropogenic global warming, this AGW, is a modern urban atheistic religion. And you've alluded to the fact that, you know, sometimes people are such true believers that you can't debate them on it. They won't debate you. They're not interested in the facts. It becomes kind of a fundamentalist conviction, which they only get mad when you throw out the facts at them. So this is part of the problem that we're dealing with, I would say, a conditioned public, to people that are conditioned to think that, you know, the earth in its pristine state is somehow a paradise, and somehow humans we're a blemish on it, we're a cancer on it. This I think is a deep kind of programming, which is very not connected to reality. So it's a religious faith, and I don't think I don't think it's a particularly good one, because it leads to a kind of a misanthropic worldview, kind of almost a self-hating, man-hating things that would justify, oh, let's let a third of the world's population die off because there's too many people. This kind of nonsense. It gets into Malthusian eugenic type of thinking. And I rattle on, but I really appreciate the conversation, Howard, and what you're doing, and it's been a pleasure. So thank you so much for what you're doing and educating us and my students.
Well, thank you very much for this long interview. It's been a great pleasure. By the way, I've met Ian Plimmer, and I served on a panel with Dick Lindzen, and so sort of because of these meetings and at the Heartland Institute, gotten to know a little bit about every one of the people that you have mentioned, and they're all fine folks. Yes, I think that the public is not quite as easily buffaloed as a lot of the people who are anthropogenic global warmers, so to speak, are inclined to believe. You know, people have a lot of common sense, and you know, there's an expression that comes from Missouri, sort of, don't tell me, show me. You know, people are, I think, generally kind of skeptical, but they sort of need information to be able to argue a little bit. And so you and I are both in the business of trying to get that information out there, and congratulations on all that you do in your classes. And Melody, thank you very much.
Well, and I want to thank you too. And again, if you want to get a hold of any of the works that you have, your website is www.energyadvocate.com.
And, that's correct.
Okay, and Eric's website is www.naturalclimatechange.us. And I want to thank you, gentlemen, and good night.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Good night. Thank you.
Good night. Okay, bye.